Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 8th, and let the record reflect it is 3:28 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Eastman, Representative Gray, myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Sydney Truitt with the Juvenile LAO. Welcome, Sydney. On today's agenda, we will bring back House Bill 129, Voter Registration, and its fourth hearing. We will then bring back House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child by Rep. Josephson in its third hearing. And we will bring back House Bill 181, State Commission for Civil Rights by House Judiciary Committee. So it is my goal to take up amendments and consider movement on a couple of them, but we will not be moving all of them. We're just trying to complete work since obviously this committee gets bumped with floor session and other things going on, so I'd like us to wrap up some work. So on introduction and wrap-up of amendments, I'm going to set a one-minute timeline, and that means that I'm going to adhere to it as well so that we can get through these and be able to accomplish our work. I intend to be done prior to House Ways and Means Committee, since half of you are, more than half of you actually, are on that committee. But let's move through and be about our business. So I will now bring back House Bill 129. In our last meeting, we've finished through Amendments 1 and 2 and now have Amendment Number 3 before us. Representative Eastman.
Yeah, for discussion.
Representative Eastman.
Very good. If you were not aware, I know it was a surprise to me when I first learned, but when you, as a member of the public, go to request public records for the voter roll for, let's say, the voter roll that was used in the last election, the answer that you get from the Division of Elections is that they don't have a copy of that because they didn't save a copy of that. I'm not exactly sure how that came to be, but It can be easily remedied. You can set an automatic backup program to, you know, back up the state voter roll every day and save a copy of that so that the member of the public or a legislative committee, if the case may be, can contact the Division of Elections and ask for, you know, what was the voter roll on a particular day in time. And that's what this amendment would require. It would require that that backup takes place so that those records become available. And that's all it does.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Do we have the Division of Elections online?
We do, and I apologize that I didn't mention that before. We have Thomas Flynn from the Department of Law who advises the division. We have Ms. Carol Beecher, the director from the Division of Elections, and Michaela Thompson, who's also a director. So I believe your question is probably to one of the two directors, if I'm not mistaken, but please go ahead.
You're correct. You're an excellent moderator. Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Division of Elections, is backing up by 5 p.m. each day a reasonable request?
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Director of the Division of Elections. Representative Johnson, I'm sorry that the unmuting line came on while you were asking your question.
Okay, amendment. Are you familiar with Amendment Number 3? Are you up to speed on that?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay, which says the director shall create a daily backup of the master register at 5 p.m. each day. Is that reasonable to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, currently the division does a backup of our database overnight at about 12 a.m. and if we were to put this into law with a specific time period, we would have operational administrative costs, and we would need to reconfigure how we interact with our system so that we wouldn't impede the 5 p.m. backups. We would have to take backups at other times to allow us to process large operations like the PFD, and we would need to further break up those processes. So it would consume more space, and it would be we could do it, but it would be costly and time-consuming to figure out exactly how to do the backup at 5 p.m.
Follow-up?
Thank you. This does not say after 5 p.m. It says register at 5 p.m. So that's a pretty specific time of day. And what's your staffing load, et cetera, at 5 p.m. on any given day? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, if that's a question for me, our staffing, we don't have people working beyond 5 p.m. on a regular basis, but the backup process is an automated process currently for the database.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And through the chair, to that specific question, if the database is backed up daily, is the previous day's database saved in its entirety in a separate file? Meaning by the end of a 30-day period, you've got 30 separate files for the picture, the snapshot of the database on any one day? Or when it is backed up, is it continuously updated so that you only have one file and only one record of the entire database? It's just current as of a particular date.
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Representative Carpenter. This is really more of an IT question to get you to the very specifics on that, but the information that I have is that we back it up every day, and it is from that point forward. We don't keep records farther back than that. It is a large database. It would expand at a rate of 2 to 6 gigs every day if we retain the list daily, which would increase hugely for storage, and then responding to those would be a challenge.
Follow up.
And this follow-up, Madam Chair, might be better directed to a technical expert on the database, but you could get to, I think what Representative Eastman is trying to get to is being able to understand what the database looks like on any given day. And depending on how you enter information into the database, you would be able to gather that information as well. So I guess the question that I would ask the administration is, can they report out of the database a snapshot of the database by a given date range?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, again, you are correct that is more of a technical question. From my question to our tech people before this hearing, the answer was that we don't retain the entire database. When it is backed up, then each time we go from the most current backup forward. So there's also a difference between the entire backup of our database, which we do for security and for to make sure that if something happens moving forward that we have that database for that day, between that and the voter registration list, which is a list that is compiled using the data in our database that is compiled by one of our staff.
That's all I have for now.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And to the director, through the chair, now you had mentioned, I think, that you have some backup processes that are going on around 5 o'clock or close to that. And you had mentioned there are some things that are backed up at 12 o'clock. Can you distinguish what are the two different things, if one of them is being backed up at 5 o'clock and one of them is being backed up at midnight?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if I said that we are backing up at 5 o'clock, I misspoke. The database is backed up at around midnight. We don't back up the database at 5.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Again, through the chair. And the voter roll that the division provides when a member of the public makes a request for a copy of the voter roll, you know, about how large of a file is that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can provide you with that information. I do not know that answer.
Follow up. Through the chair. And is that file similar or different than the file you had mentioned as, you know, some number of gigabytes?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I can also have my tech people provide that answer.
Follow up. Through the chair and to the director again. And if the amendment were to simply read midnight as opposed to 5 o'clock, would that be a good time to accomplish this kind of backup? Would that conflict with anything else the division's doing around midnight?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if it specifies a specific time, it can be problematic due to activities that can be taking place during the election cycle, during TSD when we're pulling different lists. So specifying a time could be problematic for the division to adhere to that. It could require moving other things around from my conversation with my tech.
I follow up.
One more follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. And would the division have any objection if it was just said to accomplish a backup daily?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we do back up our database every day.
Ms. Beecher, for clarification, if this amendment was amended to not include a specific time, but just say the director shall create a daily backup, would that instigate a fiscal note?
Through the chair, Chair Vance, if it was not requiring a specific time, we already do back up our database every day, but the difference is the next sentence on line 11 and 12, a daily backup of the list, which we are interpreting that to mean the voter registration list that people request from the division. That is not created every day. That is created at a request, and it takes, I think it's a couple days, we have a time frame for someone to request the list, and then we have the time for them to put it together to provide that. So the list that they're requesting takes time to get to them.
Thank you for that clarification, Ms. Beecher. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Beecher, it sounds like the first half of this amendment you're already doing, and the second half might be prohibitively difficult. Would that be a fair characterization?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, if the question is, or if the read of this amendment is that the division would retain a list of the a daily backup of the list, the voter registration list, so that somebody could say on Monday, June 3rd, I want the list from that day. That would take a lot of space, because what it would require is for every day we would have to make the list and retain that list somewhere in our database specifically to that, the voter registration list as of that day. Did that answer your question?
Follow up.
So I think, and I could be wrong, the maker of the amendment may disagree with me, but I think if there was a way of tracking the database to know what changes were made on particular days, that on June 3rd, 2022, these four people were eliminated from the list, or these 12 people were added to the list, rather than have a list of 500,000 people being saved every day, but just the differences that happened and what days those differences occurred might be sufficient. Is that currently possible, or is that an IT question?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, that it would be possible for us to make a list every day and retain it. The issue is the cost of doing that because of the space that maintaining all of those lists would take. For us to be able to narrow it down to how many people were added or taken off would be a lot of work for staff. It could potentially be costly, would potentially increase how many staff we would have to make those determinations. I would add that the list is a living document, and the staff that are on board every single day are adding people to the registration list and removing people into the inactive. So it is not a static list. It's all day long, every day, well, every work day is being added to and taken from.
One more follow-up, Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, as somebody who worked in healthcare, when we do anything in an electronic medical record, there is a timestamp of everything that we type, everything that we do. So you can always go back and tell when somebody typed something into a note. So I just feel like the technology would be there. You wouldn't have to save 500,000 names as a separate document every day. There would simply be a timestamp of when someone was added and when someone was removed from the list. So I think this might be an issue of just upgrading the technology to something that's very simple and not incredibly expensive and time-consuming. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Eastman, and wrap up.
Yes, the document we're talking about is exported in an Excel spreadsheet. We've probably all seen a copy of it one time or another. Just anyone working on a constituent, you know, type of situation probably has. You know, it's actually not a very large document when you actually open it, and you can, you know, request it and get an email link and so forth. The idea that the division already backs up their document every day, which is very reasonable. I think most of the state operates that way. And instead of retaining the public records that they have from that prior day, chooses to destroy and override it, which seems to be an obvious violation of our public records retention laws, is troubling. They should already be doing this. There is no justification for deleting a record, especially one as small as an Excel spreadsheet file of at most, you know, 500 something thousand voters. So this is the kind of thing that should take no extra time or money. And if it does, it would only be because we haven't been following the law, which we should be doing.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Will the recorder please call the roll on amendment number 3?
Representative
Carpenter?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Gray?
Pass.
Representative Groh?
No.
Representative Allen?
No.
Representative Gray?
No.
Chair Bant?
No. By a vote of 1 yea and 6 nays, amendment number 3 fails to be adopted. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move amendment 4.
Object. Object.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, unfortunately, data breaches happen on occasion. I know many of my constituents were caught up in the data breach of the voter election file here a couple of years ago. More than 100,000 voters had their security identifiers basically stolen by, well, who knows how many people got it. We know that people out of country got it, and what they did with it, well, we may never know. But their information was compromised. The, you know, confidential information they're supposed to use to verify their identity is out there. And right now we offer them no alternative other than to keep continuing to use the same security identifiers that we already know are compromised. And since you can't easily go to the Social Security Division and ask for a new Social Security number, and also equally difficult to go to the DMV and try and get a new driver's license number, this amendment allows them the opportunity of simply creating a unique social security identifier for the Division of Elections to use to verify their identity, so that they don't have to keep continuing to use the compromised information, which somebody could come in off the street and use, and the Division of Elections says, hey, you're who you say you are because you have, you know, your Social Security number, which seems like a very poor way of verifying someone's information after a data breach.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Questions? Representative Groh.
Madam Chair, I'd be very interested in what the Division of Elections would say about this proposed amendment.
Ms. Beecher, do you have any insight on this amendment? Amendment number 4.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I think that was. Your question was the division's position on this amendment with the voter unique security identifier. Is that correct?
Correct.
Through the chair, Representative Groh, one question that we would have on this is that if it was a unique security identifier selected by the applicant, and you, if you go to page 3 on number 7, the voter elected to use a unique security identifier and the voter failed to provide that, what else could they use? Would they be limited to just that so that they then could not, there was no backup for them if they were a voter? So what would it be? And it's also a question of what is contemplated by what this is, because systems and programs have sometimes limited numbers of spaces for things. So what would this identifier look like? How long could it be? Would it be letters or numbers? Those kinds of things that are, again, not necessarily my daily work with the IT, but these are the kinds of things that we were wondering if they were more fully defined in the amendment.
Follow up.
Would there be a fiscal note, in your view, associated with this amendment if it were to be adopted?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes, there would be a cost to assign a new field for a unique security identifier, and we would have to figure out how we would apply that to the different documents and to our voter list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Any further questions on Amendment number 4? And I would just like to state, while I am in support of added security for our voters, specifically relating to their ballots, multi-factor, the possibility in the future of multi-factor authentication, it is my intent to keep this bill specifically related to voter rolls and potentially hopefully with no fiscal note, so that in light of the current finances. Any further questions? Representative Eastman, wrap up.
Thank you. You know, it was our action as a state that caused these individuals' voters' information to be compromised. We need to own that. We have a responsibility to provide information that they can have confidence it's going to be used to verify their identity and is not going to be used by or could be used by someone else to steal their identity. Also, we did discuss during the drafting this amendment, what happens if someone forgets their unique identifier or doesn't have it or whatnot. And the solution that we came to was that person could verify their identity at a Division of Elections office with a driver's license or ID or a voter card, what have you, being able to provide their identity that way, and they could create a new identifier of their own choosing at that point. Which would seem to be not something that would require a lot of time or effort on the state's part. But what effort it would require, I think we owe it to people because we allowed their information to be compromised.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Eastman.
Yeah.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative
Groh. No.
No.
1 yea, 6 nays.
By a vote of 1 yea and 6 nays, Amendment number 4 has failed to be adopted. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Amendment number 5, I move it.
Object for discussion.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. This simply requires the division to verify someone's identity prior to mailing a ballot to them at an address at which they have already received return mail. So if the division understands that someone's mail has already been returned from an address, it shouldn't. I mean, it's a waste of time and expense and money to continue to mail things to that address. Now, if they decide that that they hadn't moved to that address yet and they moved there, or they want the division to continue to send information to by mail to that address, then they could verify their desire to do so. They could verify their identity with the division. The division could at that point continue to send mail to that address. But prior to doing so, once you've got returned mail back from that address, you would not be able to mail the same exact person at that same address. That doesn't work. And this is specifically dealing with ballots.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Ms. Beecher, through the chair, do we already have this in place where if a letter or a mail is undeliverable to an address and it comes back as undeliverable, do we then send an absentee ballot if a person requested at that same address under the same name?
This is Carol Beecher through the chair. Representative Allard, I have with me Michaela Thompson, and she handles absentee voting. I'm going to ask her to respond to your question.
Thank you.
For the record, Michaela Thompson with the Division of Elections. Through the chair, Representative Allard, currently with our absentee ballots, a voter has to provide an absentee ballot application where they indicate their ballot mailing address where they would like their ballot sent to. And so we do send that ballot to that address. If we do happen to get the ballot back undeliverable, which often happens when we have voters who perhaps go down to the lower 48 for a period of time and they have their forwarding services turned on too early, it will come back to as undeliverable. We contact the voter and we do not resend it to the voter until we have talk to that voter and confirm their ballot mailing address for a second time or get a new ballot mailing address from them.
Thank you for that information. That would lead me into the next question. I'm under the impression we can't forward ballots. Did I hear you say that we would, if the person is in the lower 48 because for some reason they snowbird and a ballot is sent to their house, and they put in a forwarding address, say they do it on time, are you telling me the state forwards voting ballots or election ballots?
Michaela Thompson from Division of Elections through the chair, Representative Allard. If somebody has a forwarding service on their address and we send the ballot, the USPS sends that ballot back to the division. And then the division contacts the voter again. And once we get contact with them on the address that they would like it sent to or then get resent, then we send the ballot again. So the USPS does not forward ballots. It goes back to the Division of Elections, where we then follow up with the voter.
Yeah. Okay. So then when we're looking at Section 7 of this amendment, doesn't it say what we already do?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I believe the amendment does say they have to appear in person before a registration official to verify the address. And that does not currently happen.
And we're dealing, And we're dealing with an absentee ballot. Absentee ballots, in my opinion, based on the witness signature, based on they have to furnish proper ID, whether it's a driver's license or a passport. You have to apply for that absentee ballot online. I've done it before. It's to me, it's the safest way to vote other than standing there in person. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, my concern with this amendment is living in a very large rural state that I guess it might be a question for the post office if there's ever a something returned for a legitimate reason, and then that person living in a village in the middle of nowhere is expected to appear in person. I'm not sure. I guess this is a question for the Division of Elections. Are there election officials in every community in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative, this is Michaela Thompson, Division of Elections. There are not election offices in every community across the state. We do try to have absentee voting officials in as many communities as we're able to, but we do not cover every community.
Any further questions on Amendment Number 5? Again, because this one expands the scope of the bill, I, even though I support, tightening up our process on making sure that the person we intended the ballot to get to, I will not be supporting at this time because of keeping the bill focused on voter registration. Would the recorder, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Eastman, in closing.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a picture, which I can bring forward if you're interested, but it's a picture of my my first time running for office, and you you mail out information to voters on the list, the same list that the Division of Election uses to mail out ballots, and it's a dining room table, and it's stacked high, every square inch of its cover, basically, with mail that comes back undeliverable. And you may not have that same experience. Some people go through print shops, and they, you know, use their own list to mail to voters because they already know the division's list isn't going to work. And so they just take off all the information that's not actually going to get delivered. And so the amendment is asking Division of Elections basically to do the same thing that the print shops are already doing, not sending mail, in this case ballots, to addresses which are undeliverable. We're talking thousands upon thousands upon thousands of mail, in this case ballots. And mine was just one, you know, legislative race, obviously. The whole state's a lot bigger project. But that's the ask. When we hear from the division that they're already effectively, you know, doing this essentially, and I see no reason why we would not want to encourage them to continue doing this, and we would not want to leave allowances for them to continue to mail ballots to addresses that we know aren't going to work.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Grove.
No.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Chair Vance.
No. By a vote of 2 yeas and 5 nays, Amendment Number 5 has failed to be adopted. Representative Carpenter.
Madam Chair, I move Amendment Number 6, Work Order 33-LS0668/B.9.
I object for discussion.
Mr. Almeida, would you highlight the Amendment Number 6 on my behalf, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, members of the committee, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to the Chair. Amendment Number 6, this is the final amendment for HB 29B.9. It is similar to a previous amendment that we had, but we did make some slight changes. So it deals with page 3, line 18 through page 4, line 1, subsection G, adding a new subsection dealing with the information that the division uses to verify the master register. So again, on lines 9 through 10 of the amendment, we make it clear the regulations must specify records and databases for use in reviewing the master register, and that those same records and databases must include databases, and the change being sourced from governmental agencies outside of the division. And then we hand wrote on here to make it clear our intent, which may include U.S. Postal Service, National Change of Address Database, Permanent Fund records, the Alaska Court System. And then real quick, just on page 2 of the amendment, there was a concern about the exact timing of when the division has to have this, the director has to have this done. And so we just added for lines 4 through 5 to read. I'll just read, unless disclosure of information.
All of us have to abide by the timeline, even though it's my amendment. I'm going to stick to it.
The director shall promptly, but not less than 30 days, just so it's clear. It's not very well written, but that's the amendment.
Questions from committee members on Amendment Number 6? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious about page 1, lines 17 through 19, that the director shall compare the master register to state welfare and public assistance agency databases to identify information relevant to registration to vote. And I'm curious if that's something new or something that the division's already doing.
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, the division does not, oh, sorry, Carol Beecher, director. The division does not currently compare the master register to state welfare and public assistance agency databases.
Follow up.
So,
to the chair, I think the Postal Service, the permanent fund dividend, I think those are things that everyone uses. But I feel like since state welfare and public assistance agency databases would generally be poor people, I feel like that there's a whole section in here where we're just checking poor people an extra time, and it just seems like singling them out.
Representative Gray, the intent on this was to utilize other databases that we have within the state to verify updated information.
Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question once again for the Division of Elections. Ms. Beecher, or anybody that you choose to answer this, would this language trigger an additional fiscal note, in your view?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, yes. The language regarding the requirement that the director shall compare the master register to state welfare and public assistance agency databases would trigger a fiscal note. It would require the division to implement with our system some sort of interface and probably require batches of information to go back and forth. And if we estimate that it would definitely require a fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Beecher.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. To the chair, just have like reading the list again, I was curious why we didn't include fishing and hunting license database, court records, etc. Like there could have been other things that we could have checked. And I'm just curious why we didn't do hunting and fishing licenses, for example. Thank you.
Representative Gray. The government agencies outside the division is listed, but I specifically listed those as some of the most robust lists that the state would have, as a third of Alaskans are on some type of assistance. So that was simply the intent behind that, is they would have the most up-to-date, because those forms are renewed every 6 months approximately, where the other licenses may not be updated as frequently. Brief at ease. On the record, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment to amendment number 6 that strikes the word shall on line 17 and in its place places the word may, so that the sentence would then read, the director may compare the master register to state welfare and public assistance agency databases.
Okay. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. If they may do it, then what's the point of having this amendment unless we have the shall in there? It's my only thing. I would have supported shall. I think it's a worthwhile amendment, number 6, if we change shall to may. Thank you, Madam Chair. May I?
Please continue.
There's definitely a difference in legal terms with the word may and shall. And shall is, for me, the law, where may is, maybe, maybe not. And with what we have going on with elections, it'd make me feel a lot better with the word shall. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, I'm reminiscing about how the division has sort of had trouble with the difference between may and shall in the past. I'll give you an example. So special elections, The division has been budgeted to conduct statewide primary, general, and special elections, I think pretty much since its inception. But last year, when it came time for the division to conduct a special election because someone had died in office, the division needed more time, needed more money, didn't know how to do it. And that tells me that even when we put shall in statute, like special elections, and everybody knows that it's supposed to get done, for some reason, I know this isn't the current leadership because it's under previous leadership, the division chose not to prioritize that, and they were not ready when the time came. And we could not conduct the election on dates when it would have been good to have that election. We were told because they weren't ready for a special election. And this idea that they also aren't ready to do these kinds of things, which they should probably already be doing, and they want us to budget something new and different to them. I'm just hoping that new leadership can come to grips with the idea that these are reasonable things they should already be doing, and they should not be coming to us after we need a special election or after we need them to look at the database and saying, oh, we didn't do it. We don't know. You know, we need more time. We need more money. It just it does not ring well with many of my constituents.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. I understand where Representative Eastman is going, but I'd like to also reference it was ranked choice voting, and it was a jungle primary. So it was a hot mess to begin with. So in defense of the Department of Elections, I think they were uncharted waters. And in regards to what I had said earlier about the shall versus the may, Ms. Beecher had referenced the fiscal note. Where did she come up with a number, and what would that fiscal note entail? New people? Would it mean that people would have to actually do their job more efficiently? Could she elaborate on that, please?
Ms. Beecher.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, the fiscal note would come because when you are interfacing with a database, it requires programming on both sides for the information to flow correctly. It also requires ongoing maintenance, and so there is a cost associated with that. The place that we came up with our number, because we don't know for sure exactly how much it would cost, would be based on what it cost us to do the PFD AVR interface that we do for the registration from PFD, and that cost $250,000 to implement, and has cost a lot of money ongoing to continue with that process.
Follow up.
You know, one of the biggest things through the chair that one of the main civic duties we have as Americans is to vote. And it's actually the simplest thing for us to do is to vote. And to say that there would be a fiscal note, and I think it would be a one-time cost to implement these things, is important to me. And I would say the majority of Alaskans would say so too. I'm still shocked that we don't do this already as Department of Elections. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Beecher, while I have you on this, I know that about $7 million is in the capital budget that has happened somewhat regular to be given to the Division of Elections for voter maintenance. Is that a place that could already be utilized to be able to do these type of updates?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the $7 million is for a capital project for a new voter registration system. And I asked that same question to my IT staff, if some of the things that are being asked in these bills, if they could be built into that contract, if that capital funding passes, so that we have the new technology to be able to do these interfaces and these batch processes in a more efficient manner using new technology. That would be something that we would look at when we are putting together the bid for that contract. Yeah.
So to follow up on that, by leaving the words, the director shall compare the master register to state welfare and public assistance agency databases. That's just interfacing within the state of Alaska. that you could see if that could be a part of your bid that's already appropriated in the capital budget instead of adding a fiscal note to this bill.
Through the chair, our chair, Vance, I would have to get back to you to give you specific details on that. But if we are appropriated the money for the new system will not go into place until 2020, be ready for the 2026 election, because we cannot implement it during an election year. And if we were appropriated the money, then we have to go through the whole RFP process, which pushes us into the fall and possibly into the winter, depending on what happens. So we're looking 2 years ahead for the new system. So if you're asking if we would be able to, if this word said shall, to do what is being asked by this legislation before we implemented, the answer would be that it would be a separate project that we would have to do to be able to implement that, aside from the new system.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Through the chair, why would it, and I don't know, so why would it take 2 years? Could you explain that to me? Because, dear Lord, I mean, we're in 2023. You're saying it wouldn't be available until 2026. I mean, we're in 2023. We have technology behind us, and yet we can't get something implemented in a timely manner.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if you are referring to the time frame to build the new system, part of it is the constraints of the RFP process. You have to write an RFP. You have to submit it for bids. You have to wait the requisite time period to receive all of the bids. There are procurement, state procurement rules that we have to abide by that result in a fairly long process before you can procure a system. And then once you procure the system, the ability to determine which system you're going to procure, then you have to have the technical staff that can then build the system to implement it. It is a long process, and we could not undergo that during an election year. Next year is a presidential election, so it is going to be very busy in this division. Everyone's boots on the ground starting in January to get everything done in time for the election. So it's just the logistics of the time frame that it takes to put these together.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Ms. Beecher, and I appreciate that. Could you explain to me why the process couldn't get started and then able to pull the trigger after the elections, that we wouldn't be able to implement this in 2025? I understand the rules and policy, and I appreciate your explanation, but why wouldn't we be able to get everything lined up and ready so that after the election, say December 1st of 2024, the trigger's pulled and we go right into implementing these, the process? You can have your RFP, you can have all these things lined up, and then build the system.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it's possible. In the best of all possible worlds, we are being conservative because we wouldn't want to overpromise and under deliver based on the time constraints that we have. There are just a lot of things involved in building any kind of a new system that is as large as this would be. It would require the testing, all of those different things. It is not a small list.
Thank you, Ms. Beecher.
So we are at conceptual amendment number one to amendment number six. Representative Gray.
To the maker of the conceptual amendment, through the chair, is the intention that by putting the word may in there, I guess that they don't have to do it? Is that correct?
Representative Carpenter.
I'm sorry. I did not hear my name. Is there a question directed to me?
It was the correct direction. Directed to the maker of the conceptual amendment. Is the intention of the word may to mean that the Department of Elections doesn't have to do it?
That would be the effect of the word. It would be discretion at their discretion, meaning budgets and manpower dependent.
All right. Would the recorder please call the roll to conceptual amendment number one to amendment number six?
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Grohn.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Eaton.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
68, 1 nay.
By a vote of 6 yeas and 1 nay, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 6 has passed. And that brings amendment number 6 as conceptually amended before us. I don't believe a final wrap-up is due, but Representative Gray.
Oh, thank you. I think just through the chair, there was a little discussion off the record between me and the vice chair about why I would in any way, shape, or form think about not supporting the amendment. And I just wanted to explain that in the CS document, on page 3, section 4, letter G, most of everything in this amendment is present, meaning that we'll check the post office change of address database, that we'll check the Social Security death index, that we'll look at the alien database provided by the Department of Homeland Security. All of that is there. The only thing that's being added is this, that I could see, is the compare the master registry to state welfare and public assistance agency databases. But since we've conceptually amended that and that's optional, I am okay with the amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Any further comments before we vote on amendment number 6? Okay, would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Grove.
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Yes. By a vote of 7 yeas and 0 nays, amendment number 6 has been adopted. So we will now set House Bill 129 aside and take a brief at ease to bring Representative Johnson before us, excuse me, Josephson, unless you're ready. We are going to take up amendments on House Bill 11 and brief at ease. We'll now bring back House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child, by Representative Josephson in its third hearing. The committee previously considered, invited in public testimony on this bill, and had just begun the amendment process. So I would like to mention for the record, amendment number 1 will not be offered. So we will start with amendment number 2 by Representative Eastman. Representative Eastman.
I will move adoption of amendment 2.
Object.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. This is just going to add 3 words to phrase child. This would be a child or an unborn child dealing with those who are committing assaults. You know, we have it on authority from testimony presented at some length to the committee recently that the, you know, calculation of these ACEs scores begins when the child's in the womb. And so much so that the department is ready to, you know, make statistically significant calculations on whether or not that child at age 3 and going forward is going to have academic success, workplace success, and so forth. And in recognition of that, we should not be ignoring or you know, not taking into account the impact on the unborn child, if there is an unborn child in these kinds of assault situations.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to the maker of the amendment, I'm curious if there is a particular age of the fetus in order for the crime to have been committed. And to qualify the question, if a woman didn't know she was pregnant because it was that early in the pregnancy, would this still qualify as a crime?
Any further questions before Representative Eastman responds? Representative Eastman, in wrap up.
Thank you. You know, I think.
Oh, well then.
I mean, I need to know the answer, probably, if that's okay.
Yes, please continue, Representative Eastman.
Yes, statistically speaking, we were given no particular date. In fact, it's the household circumstances, which are, you know, very important in understanding, you know, how a child's going to be impacted, and that begins from day zero, and all 9 months of pregnancy and so forth. And as far as, you know, knowledge, I think the bill itself anticipates that someone is going to, you know, have a certain level of reckless disregard for the presence of a child, and that remains unchanged. The amendment doesn't change that. If you meet that threshold for a child who's 5 years old or a child who's in the womb, it would be the same, you know, legal liability.
Follow up.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in light of the fact that this would be a crime, even if the woman didn't know she was pregnant, I don't think we can be too careful. I would move conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 2, which would insert the words unfertilized human eggs or human sperm after the word unborn child in line 2. It would insert after the word unborn child in line 5, unfertilized human eggs or human sperm. It would insert on line 8 after the words unborn child, unfertilized human eggs or human sperm. On line 11, after the word unborn child, it would insert the words unfertilized human eggs or human sperm. And on line 14, after the word unborn child, it would insert the word unfertilized human eggs or human sperm. The feeling here is that if we don't know if the woman's pregnant, we might as well protect even prior to the pregnancy itself to be on the safe side. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Object.
Vice Chair Eller.
Can we take a brief at ease, please?
Brief at ease. Any further discussion on conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2? Would the recorder call the roll on conceptual amendment number 1?
Representative Johnson. Pass.
Representative
Easton. Nope. Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Grove.
No.
Representative Allen.
Pass.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
No.
No. No.
No.
We could probably void the roll.
Will the recorder please void the roll and call it again? Brief at ease. Call the roll on conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2.
No.
No.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Grove.
No.
Representative Allen.
No.
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Chair Gant.
No.
1 yay and 6 nays. By a vote of 1 yay and 6 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 has failed. That brings amendment number 2 before us. Is there any further discussion on amendment number 2? Representative Josephson, do you have, would you please come to the table, state your name for the record. Do you have a position on amendment number 2?
Andy Josephson, District 13. I'm not going to state a position. Out of respect for the committee, although I'm sort of inconsistent, I sometimes do state a position. But I do want the committee to know that right now, unborn children are protected with A and B felonies, depending on the severity of the injury, where a fetus is seriously physically injured. And actually, in one instance, only physically injured. So I don't want the committee to think the life of the unborn child is not addressed in the criminal code. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Justice. And I think we do have a question from Vice Chair Allard.
I do. Is Mr. Skidmore here in reference to HB 11?
I believe he can be. Mr. Skidmore, would you please state your name for the record?
Good afternoon. For the record, John Skidmore, the Criminal Division Deputy Attorney General.
Vice Chair Allen.
Thank you. And through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, could you please tell us in the law that an unborn child is protected? And with this, when we say child, I reference a child as a child in the belly too. So could you clarify if this unborn child would be protected under the law?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, unborn child is actually defined in statute already. It's found in Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection B. I don't remember the subsection of B that it's there, but it does define an unborn child. It does say that an unborn child is at any stage of the pregnancy. It doesn't start at any particular time. It's at the time of conception forward. There are several statutes that are currently on our books, both for homicide as well as for assault, that are specifically directed towards unborn children. So the assault on a fetus causing harm to the fetus is already criminalized. The distinction for this particular bill is that this is a crime that occurs in the presence of. And so this is not criminalizing the bill in front of you in this amendment is not criminalizing the harm to the unborn child in the sense of a physical harm. This is trying to address the concept that there is violence that occurs in the presence of a child, or in the case of this amendment, in the presence of the unborn child. So in addition to the assault, they would also be charged with a second offense for having conducted this conduct in front of the intended target, whether it's the child or the unborn child. In terms of the rationale, I wasn't actually at the committee hearing, but I believe you heard testimony from Mr. Schaefer about ACEs, which really talks about adverse childhood experiences. ACEs expressly refers to individuals that are 0 to 17. I don't know if there's other additional studies. I heard Representative Eastman say there may be some additional information that suggests it applies to unborn children. I don't know any details about that. But the question in front of you is, do you want to add an unborn child to this particular bill, which would say there is a second charge to be filed in addition to the assault charge itself? I hope that answers the question that you've asked.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So through the chair, this is really about not committing crime, the assault in front of a pregnant woman. And the reason I say that is because a woman's uterus is not transparent. So the fetus can't see through the uterus to see the crime itself. So therefore, this is really about a crime in front of a pregnant woman, even if she doesn't know she's pregnant. So in a hypothetical, a woman is exiting a grocery store. There are two men fighting, assaulting each other. We would, if she didn't know she was pregnant and found out later, then we would need the Department of Law to go back and add this charge at a later date. Or we would need to make sure that every woman in the vicinity of an assault taking place would take a pregnancy test at that time so that we can add that crime at that time. So I just want to know, I don't know if that's something that requires a fiscal note or what, to make sure that all witnesses to assaults do get a pregnancy test so that we know that this extra crime can be prosecuted if needed. I know there's no eye contact, so I'm curious, though, if that is a if that is something that you'd be interested in moving forward with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I look down as I think about the question that you're asking. It helps me concentrate. I don't mean any disrespect by that. The answer to your question is there is not a fiscal note that is required because there is no obligation in law that we file every single charge that is possible. Having said that, I don't disagree with the notion that this particular amendment, should it be added to the bill and the bill were to pass, I agree there would be significant proof problems for prosecutors if we had to establish who was pregnant at the time. And beyond that, I heard Representative Eastman say it earlier, and I want to reiterate the concept. It requires the offender to be reckless as to the circumstance. So it's not about whether or not the female knows that she's pregnant. This is about whether or not the offender is reckless as to the fact that the female is pregnant. And establishing that they are reckless as to that fact at the time that they're committing the assault is not only that the female is pregnant, but they're aware that that pregnant female is in the vicinity. So the ability for us to prove that, I think, could be very challenging in many instances. That does not require us to add a fiscal note because it doesn't require us to do that completed investigation and literally test everybody around, which is, I think, the hypothetical that you provided me. So definite proof problems, but not a fiscal note.
Follow up.
Thank you. So back, a lot of discussion about this bill has been about 18-year-olds at a high school assaulting each other.
Okay.
So I just want to make sure that I understand the language correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If those two 18-year-olds are fighting and there are people, minors around,
mm-hmm.
the idea is that they are being reckless, that they are recklessly fighting in front of minors in the same way that two gentlemen fighting in a parking lot would be recklessly fighting in front of pregnant women. Is that the correct understanding of what you need to prove?
Through the chair to Representative Gray, yes.
Mr. Skidmore, I have a question of, you're talking about proof, and
mm-hmm.
I want to kind of pick your brain on previous cases. I've had four children.
Mm-hmm.
In one particular baby in the womb was very sensitive to my husband's driving.
Okay.
Every time he would start to, every time he would put on the brakes, so would she. And I felt a very prominent force in the womb that she was not appreciative of his particular driving. Never was an issue with the three other children, but she was highly aware
okay.
of the different circumstances where I felt stressed.
Hmm.
So in the cases that you've seen and perhaps research, is it a safe assumption that there's been proven research that the trauma that or circumstances that a pregnant woman undergoes, that child also experiences them to some degree? And with that understanding, is that something that could be used as a burden of proof that if there was two people fighting in a parking lot with a pregnant woman there who was within that vicinity, who was obviously traumatized, distressed by this assault, is that enough that they could provide reason that person caused harm to some degree? I guess what's the burden that you would need with this assault in the presence of a child in order to utilize the law as intended?
Madam Chair, the law does not require that the prosecutor prove harm to the child. That instead is a question of policy for you all here in the legislature. Do you think that this is conduct that you want to criminalize for a particular reason? So if you take the example of the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, there is research that says a child that experiences that can have these negative problems later. That's the rationale for you all passing the law. But as a prosecutor, that doesn't matter when I have to go to court and prove that case. All I would have to demonstrate or prove is that the offender was reckless as to the fact that a child was present at the time they committed the assault. If this particular amendment were to pass and then the bill is to pass, then it is the offender must be reckless as to the presence of a pregnant woman at the time that they are committing the assault. That's what we would have to prove. Not that there's any harm to the unborn child. That's a question you all would have to look at of, do you think that violent conduct can present that type of harm to the unborn child? And if you think it can, then you could pass this law, and then we would have to prove simply the presence. The information that you provide about how your child reacted to certain conduct is certainly the type of evidence that we could present in court, but it's not an element of the offense and therefore is not something that we necessarily have to prove.
So the underlying bill
mm-hmm.
says that we are we are wanting children are special.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you commit an assault in the presence of a child, we're going mm-hmm. to it's going to be a crime.
Yes.
So what this amendment is asking is a pregnant woman held to that same level of being special to warrant an additional crime. Is that a proper assessment of this amendment?
Yes.
Thank you. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair. So, Mr. Skidmore, we've been told that if you play classical music on your belly when you're pregnant, that the baby comes out happier. I got to tell you, it doesn't work. So, I guess my curiosity is, and I understand where Representative Bantz is coming from, but that was a motion, right? So when her husband put on the brakes, it was a motion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned. I guess I'm going to go ahead and give this to Representative Eastman. Do you have proof medically that this would, if I'm arguing with someone other than maybe going into premature labor, that a child comes out as something other than they would have because they heard their mom and dad argue? Because I got to tell you, I wasn't the easiest person to be around when I was pregnant. And I'm just curious through the chair, Representative Eastman, do you have any proof that a child who hears their parents argue while in the womb comes out some sort of way compared to what they could have come out as? Because I don't want to be called out on publicly that I'm not pro-life. And I think this is the avenue that we're seeing here. I guess he doesn't want to answer.
Oh, I'm still waiting. I've been waiting for 10 minutes.
Waiting for wrap up. But
okay.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Reckless disregard is the standard here, and that wasn't something I came up with. That comes from the bill itself, and I think your question is timely, and you know, could be asked to the bill itself. Is there any proof required that an assault in the presence of a child harms the child? You know, when you go to prosecute someone for this, and we just heard from Mr. Skidmore that's not an element to the crime. The child could be immensely irreparably damaged and hurt, or the child could have experienced no hurt whatsoever. Either way, it has nothing to do with whether or not you get a conviction in this case, because it's not actually, it doesn't require. Maybe we should. I happen to think crimes should have victims if you're going to prosecute someone for them. I think that's a general rule. And I think it would probably, you know, be appropriate in this case as well. If you're going to convict someone for assault in the presence of a child, but the child wasn't actually hurt, I don't know, the child had headphones on, didn't know there was assault even taking place. Okay, they were playing video games. That's not an element to the crime. They would be just as guilty under that situation as if, you know, they were 2 feet away from it and you know, were part of the, you know, the person being assaulted fell on them or something like that. Reckless disregard is the standard. It doesn't require that you look under the floorboards to see if there's, you know, little boys hiding under there. If you've read Tom Sawyer, they were at a graveyard. Injun Joe murdered his business partner in crime, and Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer saw it. But that probably wouldn't merit a conviction here, because you don't expect that a child can be hiding behind a bush in a graveyard at midnight. That's just not, you know, part of the reckless disregard standard in most situations. Now, if you knew that they were and you decided to do it anyways, that's where the reckless disregard standard comes into it. So the evidence that we've received as a committee is that children, both born and unborn, when they're exposed to these sorts of environmental stimulus, when there are assaults in the home, when all these different things are happening, are statistical predictors of what's going to happen in the future life of that child. I mean, that's statistical evidence. Is it true 100% of the time? Nope, that's what makes it a statistic. There's going to be exceptions. What's the standard going to be? I think the standard should be the same for the unborn and born alike. If we're going to say that it's a conviction, whether or not the child is injured at 5 years old, then it's certainly fair and appropriate to treat it the same with regard to the unborn child.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Madam Chair, I know this might be unconventional, but I do have just one more question for Mr. Skidmore, if you allow. If not, can I take a breath at ease?
Mr. Skidmore.
For the record again, John Skidmore.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, can you please give me again the definition of assault in the presence of a child? A person commits an assault under with reckless disregard. Is that just verbal or could it be physical?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, the assaults that are listed here for 1141-200 through 1141-230 include both assaults that result in physical injury as well as threats of imminent physical injury, which is in 1141-230 for an assault 4, and also for an assault in the third degree, which is 1141-220, there is a threat with a dangerous weapon as well that is not an actual injury, but it's just a threat. So in both instances, there are threats, but in both instances, those threats must be of imminent physical injury. It can't simply be, I'm going to shoot you or I'm going to kick your butt. It has to be, you know, you're cocking your fist and you're about to hit them or something that suggests that it's imminent. And there's significant case law on that requirement of imminence.
Follow up.
So if a woman is threatened and mm-hmm. her pulse and her heart rate and everything happens, it could trigger going into labor early. Is that hard to prove if the person goes into labor with a threat of her life?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I'm not sure what evidence we would rely on to suggest what caused somebody to go into labor at a particular time. There's a host of factors that I would think we would have to look at, and I'm not a doc in that regard, so I'd have to consult with medical providers about likely causes for that, and I don't know that off the top of my head.
7 months pregnant being pushed down the stairs. If it triggered, the woman goes into labor with something like that. Okay, thank you. It's okay, thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, we're talking about a woman watching someone get pushed down the stairs, not getting pushed downstairs herself. This is a crime of being a witness, a child being a witness to an assault, or in this case, a pregnant woman being the witness to an assault. It's assaulting the pregnant woman would be its own crime, I believe, unless the committee would like to correct me, or Mr. Skidmore. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, you are correct. If there was a pregnant woman that was pushed down the stairs, there would be an assault on the female herself, and then there is also an assault on the unborn child. So there are two types of assault that could be charged in that instance.
Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Skidmore. Would the recorder please call the roll on amendment number 2?
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Eastern.
Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Representative Brown.
No.
No.
No. With a vote of 1 yay and 6 nays, amendment number 2 has failed to be adopted. Representative Eastman.
I'll move amendment 3.
Jack.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Currently, the language in the bill is a person commits the crime of assault in the presence of a child if the person commits an assault and goes on to say more. And this would simply add or attempts to commit an assault. Making it explicit as to the legislature's intent with regard to an attempted assault. Just because someone was unsuccessful in carrying out the assault doesn't mean that the child that it's in the presence of is any better off. Again, that the assault is not against the child in this particular situation like we were just discussing. If it's not in the present, you know, if it's not the child that's the target, and they're not the one being assaulted, it's, you know, they're experiencing or watching or observing in some way what's going on. They're in the presence of it, even if their eyes are closed and they're not observing. And whether or not, you know, the assault is finalized and the woman goes down the stairs or, you know, it's a close call, certainly that would be a very adverse experience in either of those two scenarios.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Questions on Amendment Number 3? Vice Chair Allard.
Madam Chair, I don't understand the relevance of this because we just got explained what the definition of it is, and now we're being told about this amendment. It has nothing to do with what we just were told by Mr. Skidmore. This is a visual assault. This is, and he's, Representative Eastman is saying that it's physical, and in no way does this bill cover the physical aspect. So I'm not really sure if this is out of order or not, but.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's my understanding that this amendment is saying that if a child witnessed an attempted assault, that would qualify. My question, I guess, would be for Mr. Skidmore, what the legal definition of an attempted assault is.
For the record, John Skidmore again. The definition of attempt is found in Alaska Statute 1131. I think it's 100 or 110. And what it requires in an attempt is that somebody take a substantial step towards committing the target crime. And it changes the mental state. Instead of being a reckless or knowing attempt, requires it to be intentional. So it has to be a conscious objective. And so the person has to have a conscious objective to cause the assault and to take a substantial step in committing it, but it hasn't actually yet been completed.
Follow up. So to get back to my, through the chair, to get back to my hypothetical of two gentlemen fighting in a grocery store parking lot.
Sure.
The attempted assault would be he swings and misses?
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know whether this is a point of order or whatever, but there's a finite resource being wasted here. As I look at the amendments that are before us, we've discussed unborn child. We're now discussing attempted assault. We'll be discussing promoting suicide, conspiracy, human trafficking, promoting sex trafficking, promoting self-harm. And even if the child isn't the target, which is completely missing the point of the bill, this is a waste of our time to be going through these amendments. It's a complete waste of our time.
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Allard.
Can we move to table all these amendments? May I?
No.
Madam Chair, I move to table Amendment 3.
Object.
There's been an objection. Will the recorder call the roll to table Amendment Number 3.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson is absent. Representative Eastman.
Nope.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, Amendment Number 3 has been tabled. Representative Eastman, Amendment Number 4.
Yes, I move to adopt Amendment Number 4.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Currently, there's not anything on the legislative record as to as the committee's intent with regards to an assault against a child, which by definition would be an assault in the presence of a child. We have a decision to make whether or not we feel that is an appropriate circumstance under which this new crime would qualify, or whether or not that's not what we intend. If we want to simply have it the case where assaulting a child would effectively, meet the criteria for assault, and then also assault in the presence of a child, there are some, issues to work through with that. Otherwise, we could, decide that, an assault against a child would not qualify for the crime of assault in the presence of the child. But the committee has yet to make that decision, so I put the amendment before us.
Vice Chair Allard.
I'd like to move to table amendment number 5.
Object.
We're on amendment number 4.
Well, I'll get to number 5 soon enough. I move to table amendment number 4.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the recorder please call the roll to table amendment number 4?
Yes.
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 No.
Yes.
Yes. By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 4 has been tabled. Amendment number 5, Representative Eastman.
I move amendment number 5.
I object and I move to table amendment number 5.
Hearing no objection.
Object.
Would the recorder please call the roll to table amendment number 5?
Yes.
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 Nope.
Yes. By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 5 has been tabled. Representative Eastman, amendment number 6.
I don't wish to offer amendment 6.
Amendment number 6 is not being offered. Amendment number 7, Representative Eastman.
I move amendment number 7.
Object. Correct. Move to table amendment number 7.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the recorder please call the roll to table amendment number 7?
No.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Absent. Chair Vann.
Yes.
5 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 7 has been tabled. Representative Eastman, amendment number 8.
I move amendment number 8.
Object and move to table amendment number 8.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the recorder please call the vote on to table amendment number 8?
Representative Johnson, absent. Representative Eastman.
Nope.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative
Brown.
Yes. Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Chair Vann.
Yes.
5 yeas, 1 nay.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 8 has been tabled. Representative Eastman, amendment number 9.
Amendment number 9. I move amendment number 9.
Object. Move to table.
Object.
There has been an objection. Would the recorder please call the vote to table amendment number 9?
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Absent. Representative Eastman.
Nope.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Yes.
Yes. By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, amendment number 9 has been tabled. House Bill 11 is now before us. Does the bill sponsor wish to make any final comments?
Andy Josephson, District 13. I appreciate the patience of the committee. I, as a young prosecutor, noticed that the municipality had this charge. The state did not. I think that you have evidence before you about ACEs. You have a letter that we actually provided, I think, in late January from a clinician locally. You have Mr. Schaefer's testimony. I think this is a good public policy call, this bill. It provides, in this case, the state with greater ability to protect children, and it sends an important message, and I appreciate your consideration and urge passage.
Thank you. Are there any final comments on House Bill 11? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you to the sponsor for bringing this forward. Very much appreciated.
Representative Eason.
Thank you. Yeah, I saw that the municipality of Anchorage has a similar law on the books that's actually titled family. The crime is dealing with family, though the criteria I don't think require that family be the case, but that's the name of the crime. And, you know, we could, through a bill like this, we could limit its application to domestic circumstances where it's family violence or violence occurring within the household of the child and so forth. We don't have any parameters like that. It doesn't need to even take place, you know, in a building. But if it does, it doesn't need to take place close enough to the child for the child to be a participant in the action or necessarily even hear the, you know, assault taking place. They don't need to be touched by it. They may not even be aware that the assault has taken place because the way that we've written this bill doesn't require that they be aware that it took place. And if they're not aware that it has taken place, how is it that we're articulating that the child is harmed? Because, of course, the crime of assault, we already have a crime for that. We have a punishment for that. We're adding this new punishment, ostensibly based on injury to a child, but in some number of cases, someone could be convicted where the child actually isn't harmed. Certainly not in any way that anyone can demonstrate, as was spoken of earlier with some of our discussion. And that is troubling. There are ways we can target harm to a child, but that's not what this bill does. This bill just simply says, you know, if there's a child present, then, you know, maybe a crime has been committed and it's not based on anything other than the reckless disregard standard, which it seems to me that there's an idea behind this bill that's probably good, but this is a very, very, very broad bill. And I don't want that to escape the committee. And certainly we could have fleshed out some of the aspects of this on the record, but the committee chose to not do so. So that record is not before us.
Any further comments from in closing? We now have the bill before us. Vice Chair Allard, do I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House Judiciary Committee move HB 111 version 33LS-0203S as amended with the attached fiscal notes and give legislative legal services to make all technical and conforming changes as necessary.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Allard. Yes.
Yes.
Representative
Johnson,
absent.
Representative
Eastman.
No.
Representative Gray.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Yes. 5 yeas and 1 nay.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 1 nay, House Bill 11 has moved from committee. So we will take a brief at ease to sign documents. Back on the record, at our last meeting, we discussed the Human Rights Commission, House Bill 181, and that there were more changes coming on this particular wording from the commission. And we now have before us a committee substitute to accommodate those changes. Representative Carpenter, do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the House Judiciary Committee adopt the new committee substitute for House Bill 181 version. Work draft 33-LS0651/U as its new working document.
Object.
There's been an objection. Mr. Corbusier, do we have you online still? We thank you for your patience. Would you be able to walk us through the new CS as recommended by the commission?
To the chair, yes. Let me get that back up to section one. So section one is part of the name change. This is reflected in the last bill, last version. Section two is the commissioner removal provision. The for cause removal provision that includes essentially a due process right. That is also the same language that was in the last version of the bill. Section three is the annual report update. This is also the same from the last version of the bill. We removed the provision that split out doing the statewide assessment as a separate report. By having the report due on November 15th, that allows us to do the entire thing in a single publication. And it does reflect the Representative Allard's request in HB 48 that it be an electronic be delivered production. Section 4 creates an affirmative defense for an employment claim of discrimination, that if the employer is a religious entity and it has to hire people of a particular religion that are for carrying on the work of that entity, and the employee engages in activities that are ecclesiastical, spiritual, or religious, and those responsibilities include furthering the study or advancement of religion, then that position is going to be exempted from the employer is going to get an affirmative defense in a claim of discrimination. Section 5 is again from the previous version of the bill. Part of the name update. Section 6 from the previous version of the bill is for the name update. Section 7 changes the definition of employer. That is what the commission actually had originally asked for in its resolution. This is different than the language that was proposed in HB 13. Sections 8, 9, 10, and 11 are all part of the name change in the previous version of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Corbusier. That was very efficient. Do we have questions from committee members? And our objector is absent. So I think we need to take a vote to adopt the CS. Would the recorder please call the roll on adoption of committee substitute for House Bill 181?
Representative
Grove. Yes.
Representative Allard is absent. Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson absent. Representative Eastman. He is absent. Representative Gray.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes. By a vote of 4 yeas and 0 nays, the committee substitute has been adopted. This is the new working document for House Bill 181 is now before us, and it appears that members do not have any questions at this time. Thank you, Mr. Corbusier, for being available and your patience on this and your work on providing this committee substitute to us. I am setting a new amendment deadline for this bill since this is there were changes from the original. So the new deadline will be Wednesday, May 10th at noon. So that concludes our business for today. House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Wednesday, May 10th at 1 p.m. to hold first hearing on tentatively on House Bill 4, Elections, Repeal Ranked Choice Voting, introduced by myself. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 5:19 p.m.